Earlier this week, you might remember we spoke to Scottish historian and archaeologist Neil Oliver about his new TV series, Coast Australia. Wild, ancient and untouched, that was Oliver's overall impression of our coastline, particularly the West Australia and the Kimberley coast. Here's what he told us.
There was a very strong sense of the place not having changed in any kind of time frame that would make sense to human beings. I very, very often felt, if I had been here 50,000 years ago, I bet that coastline was more or less as it is today. And that feeling of the human presence being transient and ephemeral was more profound here than anywhere else I've been.
Neil Oliver talking about the first episode in his new TV series Coast Australia, which really focuses on the Kimberley Coast, otherwise known as the Dinosaur Coast. Well, today we shift our focus east to a history of the 2,000-kilometre-long New South Wales coastline, a place where human impacts are much more obvious than they are on the Kimberley, though still more than one-third is protected in National Park or Reserve. The book is simply called Coast. Its author is historian Dr. Ian Hoskins. Ian, welcome back to Breakfast.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Fran.
Ian, this book was born from your time on holiday at Currarong on the New South Wales south coast. What was the story you wanted to tell about Currarong?
Well, Currarong seemed to me to be the quintessential Australian holiday settlement.
It's a beautiful little spot.
It sure is. Lots of vintage fibro there. And so I thought about the possible history of Currarong and assumed that it perhaps had a history as a fishing village or something like that. And it turns out it didn't. It always was a suburban subdivision and then a holiday settlement. And that seemed to me to epitomise so much of our relationship to the coast. It's a very recent one, and it's one that's essentially recreational and fun-based, you know, and more recently there's a desire to get your beach house there. But there's a much longer history that goes back to the 19th century and clearly a very deep Aboriginal history as well.
Well, I've had the honour of being able to stay at other people's beach houses there, and it is lovely, and they are fibro, and they're beautiful. But you were, in your history of the New South Wales coast, you were wanting to paint people into this picture. And for Europeans, that began 200 years ago, for areas like Currarong, probably something less than that. For Indigenous Australia, thousands of years ago. And at Currarong, we find the intersection of the two?
Yeah, that's what was so fascinating about Currarong. So as I started poking around as a historian on holidays, you know, there is an Aboriginal archaeological site there, you know, that's been interpreted, and that goes back several thousand years. That's not the oldest one on the New South Wales coast. There's evidence at Baril Lake that people were there 20,000 years ago or more, and indeed they were down in Tasmania. Mm. So almost certainly they were on the New South Wales coast in those periods. That's a very deep history. So it's, you know, I've written a social cultural history of a coastline that in many parts may seem to be untouched by humans, but clearly is a cultural landscape because it's been understood by humans and in many places shaped by humans as well.
And in many of these coastal regions, still very active Indigenous ownership and living, I mean, parts of Jervis Bay, for instance?
There are, yes. They're good examples of lots of Aboriginal ownership and management of coastal sites and ongoing stories of important sites. You know, there's an extraordinary basalt rock formation up near Fingal Head, which looks just what it is supposed to be. It's an echidna from The Dreaming. The five islands off Illawarra are believed to be the daughters of the West Wind, I think, according to Wadi Wadi legend. So there are many stories that have survived.
I think these days in modern Australia, we think about the annual summer holiday as quintessentially Australian. You know, that's what Australians do in summer. They go to the beach, and it's a great leveller because it doesn't matter how much money or how little money you've got, you've all got access to the same beach. And yet, in the past, the kind of sense of the Australian identity has got nothing to do with the beach or the coast. It's all about the bush, isn't it? The miners, the drovers, the bush battlers. Coast really barely makes a mention.
Well, that's my argument that our, you know, our current obsession with the coast and desire to be surfers or, you know, the owners of wonderful beachfront real estate.
Or just a bit of striped canvas down at the sand.
Which could be as simple as that, or it could be a caravan at the, you know, Kingscliff Caravan Park comes alive every Christmas. It's a wonderful place, for sure, absolutely. But my theory is that through the 19th century we develop an Australian identity, a colonial identity that then becomes an Australian identity, which is very much bush-based, so all the legends and the ballads. It was very hard to find a sea shanty of any sort of Australian import in the 19th century. There are plenty of English or American derivation, but I had trouble finding Australian ones. But there are plenty of bush ballads. Mm. So that's the difference. Through the 19th century, we inherit a British attitude to the coast. And we often look down our noses at the British because we regard ourselves as having the best beaches, and we probably have. But clearly the British were going to the sea and having holidays by the sea in the early 18th century, and that's what we picked up on in the 19th century here. It's a still water culture. But when we discover waves at the end of the 19th century, that's when something uniquely Australian develops.
It's 21 minutes to nine. Our guest this morning is Dr. Ian Hoskins. He's an historian and author of a new book called Coast, looking at the history of the New South Wales edge. We'll get to the waves in a minute, but you actually talk about the social revolution that occurred at the end of the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th century, which played out on the beaches. You call it a moral battle. Tell us about that.
Well, in the 1890s, there was an all-day surf bathing movement, which was almost like civil disobedience, an attempt to overturn council bylaws that said you couldn't go to the beach, that's the beach, without a bathing enclosure during daylight hours. So you had to do it sort of very early in the morning or late in the evening.
That was a law. You couldn't just go and stroll around
laws,
the beach.
Yes. Whatever council was in charge of a beach, you know, had set that law, you know, and varied in places, but generally it was a dawn to dusk type curfew on a beach.
You could swim. On putting bathers on.
Yes,
and walking around.
But by definition, on putting bathers and going into the beach and therefore sort of revealing your body. Now, this was being contested through the 1890s, and it really was overturned in the first decade of the 20th century at various Sydney beaches. Manly is probably the most famous of these. And to look at the photographs of people bathing at Manly, for instance, in very tight swimsuits in the early 20th century, compare that with only, say, a decade earlier, where they're still in their white dresses and pulling their white dresses up, but just letting the waves lap around their ankles. It's a profound change. It's a profound change in our attitude to the surf, but our attitude to morality as well.
Our attitude to women, I think.
And women too, yes, because women are there as well. Now, sometimes they're being looked at by the men, and there's clearly a lot of voyeurism going on, but there's a lot of freedom being
liberation going on.
Absolutely, too.
Talking about revolutions, at the beginning of the 20th century, another revolution occurred, surfing, body surfing and board surfing. Where did surfing come from?
Well, the story goes that there's a chap called Tommy Tanner, who was a native of Tanner, one of the Vanuatu Islanders. He was a gardener at Manly in the late 19th century. He brought that Pacific love of riding waves, either with your body or on a board, to Sydney. And he introduced it and took off from there. In the early 20th century, we have shortboards. And even before Duke Hanamoku came in 1915, there were longboards being imported. So Manly seems to be the crucible for this sort of extraordinary, originally body surfing and then board riding revolution again.
And women were there right from the start of that
and
too?
And women were there from the start. So Isabel Leatham is a name that would be known to many who are interested in the history of surfing. And she rode with the Duke around 1915, and she was still alive in the 1990s to be photographed with Pam Burridge. So there's a lovely connection there.
So many great stories, because it also goes to how suddenly the coast became a place of expensive real estate. It wasn't always that, but you're going to have to read the book if you want to read Ian's telling of this history of the development of our coast and our life on the beach. Ian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Ian Hoskins, author of a new book called Coast, A History of the New South Wales Edge. It's published by New South Wales Books, of course, and it's out now. It's 18 to 9 on Breakfast.